I would invite you to grab a Bible and turn to 1 Peter chapter 1. I want to read verses 3, 4, and 5. 1 Peter chapter 1, 3 through 5. And Gavin and Jackson, it's a pleasure having you with us this morning. I'm glad you could be here. Verse 3. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to His abundant mercy has begotten us again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to an inheritance incorruptible and undefiled and that does not fade away, reserved in heaven for us, who are kept by the power of God through faith for salvation, ready to be revealed in the last time. Any of you here have a living will? Now, the funny thing about a living will is that it doesn't really have much to do with living. It has more to do with dying. It's a document that you have prepared and you sign that stipulates the situations in which artificial means of life are turned off. Life support systems are turned off. Now, I don't have one. I don't know if I'll ever have one. Maybe I will, but a lot of people are concerned with having a living will, but I'm more concerned this morning from our passage as to whether or not we have a living hope. That's the greater question this morning. Do you have a living hope this morning? That's the language of Peter. The distinguishing feature of a Christian, or one of the distinguishing features of a Christian, is that they have hope. A continual looking forward to heaven is something that Christians are meant to do. But if we're honest with each other, I think we will have to admit that for most of us, we don't have a good handle on our hope. I don't think for most Christians, hope fills their life and blesses their life the way it's meant to do. The reality is, most Christians have a hard time looking forward to heaven. And when we think about heaven, what we usually think about is that there in heaven we'll be with our family and friends who have died, who have gone on. And for most of us, I think our thinking stops at that point. But Christian hope, while involving a reunion, involves a great deal more. And it's important as Christians that we have our focus on the future. In fact, it's been the people, the men, women, who have had their focus on heaven who have done the most to help people in this world. The slave trade was abolished by people who were believers, by people who looked to heaven. Hospitals have been built to treat the sick and the injured by people who looked to heaven. All kinds of great social changes have come about because people were looking to heaven. And the reality is that the less our focus is on heaven, the more ineffective we're going to be in regard to earth, in regard to helping people on earth. But as I said, most of us find it difficult to think about heaven, to think about going to heaven. One of the reasons for that is because we are immersed, our thinking, our attention is immersed with things of this world. We're not trained, we're not taught to think about heaven. Everything that we're trained and taught to do has its mind set on this world. And for that reason, because we live in a world that tries to deny us the blessings of our hope, I want to spend one final lesson this morning from 1 Peter 1, talking about hope. Paul, John, and Peter are notable among the apostles because of their connection with the Christian virtues. Paul is called the apostle of faith. John is called the apostle of love. Peter is called the apostle of hope. And certainly Peter has some important things to say about hope. And we're going to look at these from 1 Peter 3, 4, and 5. But I want to start by asking you to go back to Ecclesiastes. If you've got an Old Testament, Go back to Ecclesiastes chapter 3, where Solomon talks about the rhythm of life. Routines are part of the stabilizing features in our life. We know what's to come next. We get up, we go to work, we come home, we go to bed. We have that sort of routine in our life. Every year when December rolls around, we pull out the Christmas tree, we pull out ornaments, and we put them up, and we have that routine. So in life there is this rhythm, and that's what Solomon's talking about in Ecclesiastes 3 when he says, "To everything there's a season, and a time for every purpose under heaven." And he talks about the things that take up our life and what flows out of certain things. And these elements, as important as they are to enjoying life, can nevertheless be somewhat confusing. Because there are things involved in life that the rhythm of life does not provide. Look at verse 12 of Ecclesiastes chapter 3. "I know that nothing is better for them than to rejoice and to do good in their lives." Now, we need to be enjoying our life. Whatever comes our way in life ought to be blessing us in some way. We ought to be getting the most good out of it that we can. But the problem is that we want the good things in life to last, and they don't last. As good as things are, as long as they are never long enough. They eventually are going to go away, and that's because we live in a temporary situation. There is nothing permanent about this life that we're in. Look at verse 11 of Ecclesiastes 3. "He has made everything beautiful in its time," and we can all attest to that. There are things in life that we find beautiful and enjoyable and we want to engage in. "Also, he has put eternity in their hearts." There is a part of us, I'll talk more about this in a minute, that cannot be satisfied by anything temporal. God has put a desire for the permanent, for the eternal, into our hearts. But look at the very end of verse 11. "He's put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end." We never get the big picture. We are in the dark about many things. God has not told us everything that we might like to know. He's certainly not given us in this life everything that we might desire. C.S. Lewis is a name that many of you are recognize or familiar with. And in his book, Mere Christianity, he has a chapter about hope. And I want to read you a couple of lines that he writes in this book that pertains to the fact that this life cannot ultimately satisfy desires that we have. Here's what he writes. "If I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. If none of my earthly pleasures satisfy it, that does not prove that the universe is a fraud. Probably, earthly pleasures were never meant to satisfy it, but only to arouse it, to suggest the real thing." Let me try to talk about what Lewis writes there. There are things in life that when we encounter them, we think this is it. This is what's been missing. This is what I'm looking for in life. First love. You know, you fall in love. Whatever that means when you're 16 years old, you fall in love and you think, man, it doesn't get any better than this. And you find the perfect one. You find your soulmate. And you're so excited and you're enjoying the company of the other. And you get married. And before long, this perfect one that you married, this one you couldn't bear being apart from, this one you thought about 24 hours a day, you're asking yourself, what did I ever see in this person? I mean, the satisfaction, the enjoyment, the pleasure is gone. You grow up, you think you'd like to be something. You'd like to have a particular occupation. And so you take classes, you go to school, you study, you take courses that you can be what you want to be when you grow up in life. You can be what you want to grow up to be. And you become that. And before very long, you can barely drag yourself out of bed in the morning to go into that boring job. Because the satisfaction you gain from your work, from whatever it was you're doing, it's soon gone. And you hear about a place you'd really like to go to, so you plan a vacation. You're going to have a getaway, you make all the arrangements to go to this place, and you're going to have a great vacation, and you get there, and within 1, 2, 3 days, you're thinking, I don't know why I ever thought about coming to this place, whoever recommended it to me, I don't know what they were thinking. And so in various ways, in very common ways, life fails to satisfy us. God put eternity in our heart, and we haven't found the person, we haven't found the spouse, we haven't found the job, we haven't found the hobby, we haven't found the recreation that keeps that hole that's meant for eternity in my heart full. And what C.S. Lewis says is that that recognition, that reality, should tell us that we might be meant for a world other than this one in which we live. Every desire we have is a God-given desire. And God doesn't taunt us. God doesn't play tricks with us. God has given us certain desires, and He's put us in a world that cannot ultimately fulfill those desires. And the conclusion we ought to draw is that we are meant for another world, and therein comes our hope. Our hope is for that other world. Now, when people realize this life cannot ultimately satisfy them, what do they do? Well, some people decide that they were foolish in wanting what they wanted, in wanting this person to be their spouse. They made a mistake. They picked the wrong person. In wanting to have this occupation, they were wrong. They really weren't cut out for the work they're doing. They made a mistake. They were foolish. In going to this vacation spot, in having that hobby, and they find out they are empty as a result, they made a mistake. They were foolish. That's how many people explain not finding permanent satisfaction. And so they go from spouse to spouse to spouse. They go from job to job to job. They go from church to church to church. I'm going to be a member of this congregation because this is going to provide all I need. And it doesn't. And so they go to another church thinking the next church will provide all I need. It doesn't. And they just go on and on and on like that. That's a very common explanation people come up with as to why they're not satisfied in life. Others simply accept the disillusionment of it all. They take a very stoical view toward life. Their attitude is that we should never expect to find any joy or happiness in life. Therefore, we're not going to be disappointed when we don't find it. Since we're not going to find fulfillment in the things of this world, just take life for what it is. Don't expect much. Don't set your hopes too high. And you'll not be disappointed when life disappoints you. That's thought to be the very sensible way to deal with life. But there's a third way. And that's the way that Peter talks about. When Peter talks about a living hope, he is talking about another way of viewing life than the people who decide they were foolish, the people who decided, I'm not going to be disillusioned, not going to be disappointed. Here's what Peter says. He agrees with Solomon that God created a beautiful world. He agrees that we can find the good life. He's going to talk about people who want the good life here in a couple of chapters. He knows that God put eternity in our hearts. And he further knows that this life, even the best of things in this life, cannot permanently satisfy that area saved for eternity. And so what God has given us in this life is a living hope. And like Paul says in Romans 8, we're saved by hope. Hope will save us from thinking we were foolish. Hope will save us from disenchantment and disillusionment. And hope will bring our focus to bear on the place, heaven, where God will permanently satisfy all the desires He created and gave us. Now here's what the Bible says. The Bible says that man is the image and glory of God. 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 7. That's how God created us, in His image, to His glory. But Romans 3:23, all have fallen short of the glory of God. All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. And so what God has been working on since we fell short is bringing us back to His glory. Romans 8:17. He wants us to share, all of His followers to share in His glory. The book of Genesis tells us that God created the world. He created a perfect world. He created a world that He said is very good. And then man blew it. Man made a mess of things. And because of that, God had to go back to work. God created the world, He finished the world, and He rested. Man made a mess of things in Genesis 3, so God had to go back to work. I'm reminded of the lines from Kipling. If you can bear to hear the truth you've spoken, twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools, or watch the things you gave your life to broken, and stoop and build them up again with worn out tools. God had to start all over, in a sense. He had to go back to work. Not the work of creating the world, but the work of recreating the man that He has put in this world. And so God, as part of His creative work, Peter says in verse 3, has begotten us to a living hope. We've been born again to a world of hope, and that is a radical difference between the Christian and the non-Christian. We have hope, the non-Christian doesn't. Peter says that we're a peculiar people. He calls us that in 1 Peter chapter 2. But we live in a world that has gone pagan. Every day we get up, the country in which we live is more pagan than it was the day before. And one thing pagans don't have is hope. If they have hope, it's not based on the certainty of Christian hope. It's a hope based on possibility. After all, anything's possible. Or a world based on probability. That's not the basis of the Christian hope. Christian hope is based on what's certain. Our hope is in heaven, and we're certain there's a heaven because God says there's a heaven, and God cannot lie. Let God be true, but every man a liar. If God says there's a heaven, there's a heaven. If God says we're going there, we're going there. And that is the basis of our hope. Now, there's similarities between us and pagans. I mean, you get up and you take your kids or grandkids to school just like the pagans do. and you engage in sports, and you go to work, and you do all kinds of things the pagans do, but there's a radical difference. We've been born again. And the first blessing of being born again, according to Peter, is this living hope. God has given us hope. It's hope that's certain. Dante, in his book on hell, The Divine Comedy, Dante says that when you get to Hades, there was a sign that reads, "Abandon hope, all ye who enter." Now that's what the pagan has to look forward to, but not the Christian. And you know, the world takes note of what it cannot produce. And so in 1 Peter 3:15, Peter says, if anyone asks you a reason for the hope that is within you, if you live a life that is full of the certainty of coming glory and heaven, people are going to notice that about you, and they're going to ask what makes you tick. They want to know why you're different. They're going to ask why you can be joyful when everybody else is sorrowful. Why you can be up when everybody else is down. Why you can still stand when everybody else is fallen. They'll want to know all of that. And that gives you an opportunity to talk to them about their hope. Here's the kind of things the world comes up with when they talk about hope. They talk about Ted Williams. Ted Williams, one of the greatest baseball players ever. Last major leaguer to bat 400. When Ted Williams died, his head was cut off his body and put into a deep freeze at minus 370 degrees. Cryogenically frozen, in hope that somewhere in the future, science is going to figure out how to bring his head back to life. Now, the reason he didn't have his entire body frozen is because that would have cost $120,000, but just freezing his head was $50,000. And Ted Williams' hope, his family's hope, is that somewhere down the line, science will figure out how to rejuvenate Ted Williams. I hope the power never goes out on the freezer. But that's his hope. And that kind of foolishness is the best that the world can come up with. Is that the kind of hope you have, that science is going to keep you alive? That science is going to figure out how to cure what you've got? If that's your hope, you don't have a living hope. Now, Peter can talk about what it means to have a living hope. And we talked about that a couple of weeks ago. Peter would tell you, if he was here, Peter would tell you, on the eve of Christ's crucifixion, I was devastated because I went down to the courtyard of the high priest and a little girl came up and said, "Why, you're one of his." And I said, "I don't know him." "Oh, no, you know him. I know you know him. You're one of his. I'm telling you, I don't know him." I said that three times. I even cursed and swore. "I swear to God, I don't know him." And then I saw Christ being led out of the high priest's house, and I was crushed. I've never hurt more. I've never cried harder. I've never felt worse than I did that night. The worst night of my life. And I was hopeless that night. 2 days later, Sunday morning, some women come and find me. And they're excited. And they tell me, "We've seen the Lord." And there was an angel who told us to tell his disciples and Peter. And Peter said, "Wait a minute. You've seen the Lord and you were told to come tell the disciples and Peter?" "Yeah, that's what the angel said." Now, he really said that? It's not just you saying that, are you? You're not just trying to make me feel better, are you? He really said, tell the disciples and Peter. And the women said, as we're standing here right now, that's what he said. And hope came back to Peter. And Peter says, I met the Lord. I have had a private meeting with him. And a few days after that, we were up in Galilee and we'd been out fishing and we came in the morning and the Lord was there on the shore. He had fixed breakfast for us and he took me aside and he said, Peter, do you love me? 3 times he wanted to know if I loved him, and I assured him, Lord, I love you. And though I was devastated the night of Good Friday, I was reinstated there on the shores of the Sea of Galilee, and I went back to Jerusalem, and I didn't care who in town knew it, that I loved the Lord. Now that's what hope did for Peter. That's what a living hope is all about. Do you have that kind of hope right now? And do you have the excitement and the conviction that is born of hope like that? Someone says, well, I can't have a living hope because I'm not good enough. Well, of course you're not. The living hope, 1 Peter 1:3, is because of mercy. Of course you're not good enough. But mercy still gives you that kind of hope. Someone says, well, I know, but I just am not good at sticking to what I start. I start things, I don't follow through, I don't finish. I'm okay for a while, and then I just give it all up. There are two words I want you to look at in 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 4 and 5. In verse 4, Peter talks about our inheritance, and that's talking about what we get in heaven. You know, one guy said, "If there where there's a will, I want to be in it. And if Christ has a will, I want to be in His will. And the New Testament is His will, and I am in it, and you're in it. And so we have an inheritance incorruptible, undefiled, that doesn't fade away, reserved," underline that word reserved, "in heaven for you." That word reserved means to secure, to guard. It's a safety deposit box. God has put us in a safety deposit box. You think you're not good enough to hang on, you think you can't do it. God's guarding you. And look at verse 5. Who are kept by the power of God. God's not only put you in a secure location. He's got a guard posted out front. That's what the word kept means. Reserved speaks of the location, the secure place. Kept speaks of the guard in front of the secure place. The Jews wanted to make sure Christ never left the tomb. And so he was put in a rock tomb, a stone sealed the tomb, and then they put a guard out front. And that's what God's done with us. Paul in Romans chapter 5, verse 9 and 10 says, if Christ died for us when we were His enemies, much more does Christ live for us to get us to heaven. Christ is working harder now than He worked in the crucifixion to get His people to heaven. What a comforting thought that is. He died to save us. He was raised to life. And in His life, He lives to keep us saved. It's awfully hard for a Christian to lose heaven once they've had it. It's possible. It's possible. You go back in unbelief. It's possible. But God's doing everything He can to make sure that does not happen. And for that reason, Hebrews 6 talks about us fleeing and laying hold on the refuge of hope. We've got a song that we sing about that. Will your anchor hold in the storms of life? When the clouds unfold their wings of strife, when the strong tides lift and the cables strain, will your anchor hold or firm remain? Do you have a living hope? And the answer comes in the chorus. We have an anchor that keeps the soul steadfast and sure while the billows roll, fastened to the rock which cannot move, grounded firm and deep in the Savior's love. Do you have a living hope that will secure you? Mark, do you think you could lead 776? Will your anchor hold? If you don't think so, I'll lead it. I'd like us to close with that. You think you can lead that one, or do you want me to? Okay, turn to 776. We're going to sing about our hope, the Christian hope, all that it does for us. If you've not been born again, if you'll surrender to Christ on His terms, repenting of sin, confessing that He is your Lord, being baptized, immersed in water for the remission of sins, you'll be begotten to a living hope. Not a Ted Williams hope. Not the hopelessness of the world. You'll have a real reason to live every day to the glory of God.